What is the future for cities? Do you want to learn more about them? Do you want to know how others think about them? Do you want to be part of the conversation? Then this is the right place.
Welcome to What is the Future for Cities podcast. Today, I will interview Eamon Bayerle, architect, urban designer, and lecturer. We will talk about their vision for the future of cities, participatory design, the three ecologies, affordability, and many more. So let's start with a proper introduction. Eamon Bayerle is a practicing architect, urban designer, and academic with a specialty in participatory design. They recently completed a PhD in participation in architecture and urban design in 2018 and have 18 years teaching experience across a broad range of design, theory, and technical subjects at four universities in Melbourne, Australia. Eamon's PhD was by creative works, including work from their architectural practice, and focused on agonism, which meant, rather than pursuing the rational ideology of consensus, embracing tensions, frictions, and action in design processes. Prior to starting their own practice, Eamon worked in a structural engineering atelier in Paris on public projects across Europe, China, and Africa, in international architectural practices in Japan and Melbourne, and then in community activism and sustainability in Melbourne. Eamon's architectural practice, Here Studio, has a base in both the city of Melbourne and the regional city of Ballarat, Victoria. Over 12 years, Here Studio has led projects in community development, placemaking, and social enterprise, and embedded participatory design methods via running events, newsletters, art installations, startups, and action research. Over the past 6 years, they have strived to prove that architecture can be accessible to everyone, making it their business to deliver more than 150 modest budget residential renovations, extensions, and new homes across Victoria, Australia. And with that, Eamon, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for your time on the podcast. What does the future of cities mean to you?
Such an abstract question there you've got, Fanny. It brings up hope and pessimism and responsibility and lots of like raison d'être stuff about why I do what we do, and brings up all of that. I think it probably brings up agency in a really big way for me. That's what I would probably be flying as a flag. Future of cities is about agency. And I think that agency is different people, and it's also different individuals, but it's also things that are just beyond people, or groups of people, businesses, families, also non-humans, all sorts of systems that are acting and happening. And I think that the future of cities is something that, whether or not it sort of takes over us or do we start to shape it, is kind of the relevant question for me. Is it something that appears, or do we make it happen? And there's a process of also letting go, I think, in that.
What do you hope for?
Changes day to day, but I do hope that particularly some of the changes we're seeing at the moment, I think it's impossible not to talk about post-COVID sort of situations and the realization that people got quite deep into in themselves. I think I would hope for a certain level of integrity going forward between what people want their lives to be like and what it is like, but also kind of an adjustment where people are connected to reality. I think that there are some major changes that have to happen in the world if we want to live in a particular way. And there's very little time to work on some of these things. And like, if we're thinking about environmental sustainability, for instance, a lot of this stuff is a long way past gone. But there are some opportunities, I think, to still take action and make some changes, and for people to be empowered in that process of making changes. My thing has always been about public participation, or participation in general, of people in the world. And I think we have cities that are unmanageable for individuals, let alone groups, let alone governments, and somehow developing processes and empowerment of individuals and groups in the making of a city is what really interests me, and I think is kind of a horizon of where we should be moving towards. And I think this sort of post-COVID thing was in many ways like a adjustment of are we actually going where we want to go? Started to play with our sense of power and things.
Do you feel pessimism because we don't really direct ourselves towards something better? Or why do you feel pessimism?
in 2009, I went to Copenhagen to that conference, and there was a lot of hope and optimism about that. And I saw what happened there. I was coming from Australia. It was an interesting time. We had Kevin Rudd and things like that. There was a time of a lot of hope of addressing things. And then I saw what happened there. I saw the role that businesses and innovators were playing, and even the role of, and I'll say it this way just for conversation, second and third world countries. And then I saw what first world countries were doing. And I left feeling really distraught and overwhelmed and depressed about it all. I think I was quite ashamed to be Australian when I left there, and a bit disgusted with everything. And I'm not super pessimistic like that, but more just like I got to see how some of these important systems are entrenched in such a way that they won't allow, there's not an allowance of change, where actually a lot of this stuff is actually happening out there. So there was really interesting conversations around per capita emissions. There was interesting conversations around Kuznet curve stuff about developed countries have already got to this space by living a particular way. Don't other nations have a right to get there in their own way as well? And some of the reparations, just there's such a gap in all of that. I don't think a singular vision is really, I no longer believe that that's possible. I think it's not. And I think over the years, more and more, I've probably become a little bit more focused in my own practice and the way I work and my sense of hope in kind of empowering individuals and self-formed collectives and things like that to do things and for people to become more informed and critical, etc. Since I went there, I started and finished a PhD on participation, and I also did another 12 years of teaching in architecture and urban design. So since then, I've probably developed this sort of understanding. It's almost like a bit more of understanding of individual agency or collective agency, as opposed to trying to develop everyone has to have one vision of the world. And I've really got into, delved into pluralism and difference and the positive values of that and passions. And since then, I did my PhD. That took me almost 10 years, which was about participation in architecture and urban design. And that focused on agonism as a sort of action-orientated way of doing participatory design. And I also developed a practice called Here Studio, which is an architecture practice in Ballarat and Melbourne, and it's nearly 12 years old. And the first half of that time, we did a lot of public projects. And then the last 6 years, we've developed like a very clear methodology about delivering affordable everyday architecture. And I think as my career has gone on, it's probably been a bit more about how do we practically do things by empowering people.
Do I understand correctly that your experience in Copenhagen changed your ideas that, for example, sustainability cannot come from top to bottom and it should start from the bottom up?
Like, I always had these sorts of values, but I really saw how impossible it was to come from top down. I think there's a role there, but it's almost, it's questions of the way the regime of the world works, etc. But it was awful things. I saw the role of Indigenous people and knowledge on the planet and all of that ecofeminist stuff as well. There's such a barrier to actually making that come forward and being more prominent. So I'm no longer hopeful around the top-down approach. Mm-hmm. No longer hopeful about that. I see moments of things happening politically and sometimes want to get involved, but often get disappointed. So I'm busy trying to work on the ground and teach next generation and figure out how to do it in everyday projects.
Which is awesome, to be honest. What does participatory design mean?
It sort of started for me in environmental design. I was interested in people taking responsibility for the environment that they were in. And it was really clear to me that cities are pretty overwhelming and interesting places where there are just so many layers of, I don't know, barriers to people being able to leave a mark, to trace their city, to influence their city, that it makes a lot of sense that people don't take responsibility because they don't really feel empowered. So there's a lot of work to do to figure out how to empower people in the making of cities. And as the scale goes up and up, it gets more and more complicated. And in a way, it becomes uncoordinatable. It actually gets too big. And that's what a city is about. Think back to that, what I said about post-COVID. I think in some ways we sort of met the absolute face of the limits of all of that. And people are sort of now, you know, shifting jobs focusing a little bit on what's more important to them in their lives, changing careers a bit, refocusing, because we've faced the four walls of the limits of this way of being. I don't know where it's going to go next, but I do think that we need to develop systems and processes of people being involved in making their own lives, interacting with other people and deciding making things with other people and debating making things with other people in all their differences. It's not some rosy future per se. We actually have to get in and start having arguments with each other.
How do you connect urban design and citizen participation?
Well, participation, back to your question a little bit, is about people getting involved in design, making decisions, understanding how decisions are made, not just decisions, like actually getting involved in, I don't know, debate of how things work, deciding to get involved, deciding not to get involved in a critical way. That's what participation is about. And it's often a lot about action. In a way, even non-participation is a kind of a form of action. And there's all sorts of verbal and non-verbal forms of power going on here. But I guess I would like to put forward that as designers, architects, urban designers, we have a first responsibility to design the processes that we are coordinating, running, managing, whatever you want to say. We design that process so that we keep alive the opportunity for people to interact with each other, with the project, to influence the project, to be influenced by the project, to learn, to grow, to, I'll say, evolve, that we keep open that possibility in the project and that we work really hard to do that. It's very hard to do that, I think, for lots of reasons. Coming out of modernism, coming out of this rational idealism that's been around for a long time, it's difficult. And then the economy requires us to be really developed at each of our games. We become highly expert at what we're doing. It gets very complex. How do you bring in lay people? How do you bring in other knowledges and assets into that process? We have to be really top of our game thinking about how do we bring people into the design process. It's not just informing, it's being informed by and teaching and learning as a process, if you like. So in urban design, I think it's particularly hard because you've got space that is often normally about public space, even if you're doing some urban design for a medium scale building that's a private developer, for instance. It has a street interface. Urban design's all about public realm. How does it negotiate that? There'll be benefits for the landowner, et cetera, and the residents, but there's a responsibility beyond just the client. And I think in terms of participation, it's challenging because who are the participants is kind of a question. When do you want to do this? And it depends on your relationship with the client, the funds available, the risks, et cetera, how much rapport you have with somebody to take some risks. And then making decisions, yeah, like who makes those decisions and how do you get other people involved in those decisions or processes? It's challenging. So I think when it comes to urban design, it has such an impact on culture, on how people live together, relationships to neighbours, simple things like overshadowing, movement, activation, such. They have huge impacts on everybody, but almost nobody owns it individually. So the design process has to be carefully designed. I mean, we often hear of concepts of place and placemaking, activation and all this sort of stuff, which are all tools that we can use. But when do we use them? How do we use them? What tone? Maybe at the start of a project, it's about activating and exciting and building up ambition and intention. And then in the middle of the project, it's about, let's start to have some arguments about what we could do and how we could take these steps and what are the key things that we're working through and what are the key principles. And then beyond that, it's actually the experts, designers and other technical specialist consultants integrating and coordinating some sort of a project. This is still open. A few options are available, getting feedback as you go forward, but it starts to become less directly controlled by the citizen participants, and it becomes more and more controlled by the architect or urban designer, etc., project manager, whoever you're working with. There's a spectrum. And I think designers that are engaging with participatory design, we actually have to think, particularly in an urban design project, we have to think through that spectrum and the steps along that spectrum all the way through. Like a key thing is about working out how to remove ourselves. If we're leading a project, thinking about there's a concept called tutelage, which is you're sort of leading things, you're teaching people, but actually at one stage or another, you've got to move out so they can do it themselves. You can't have someone orchestrating a community process and then suddenly even the whole community process is over. You want that process to continue after you've left somewhere or another.
Is there a difference regarding participation between architecture and urban design?
I think you're asking more about what is the difference between architecture and urban design. I think, of course, they're different, but the way I see it, it's a bit more of a spectrum. And I don't think it's like a linear spectrum of either small scales architecture and the big scales urban design. I just think when we start to invoke these terms, it kind of brings us responsibilities such as, okay, if I'm going to talk about urban design, the brief I'm focusing on is not just my client's brief, and it's not just my interest as a creative person making my vision in the world, but it's actually considering the broader societal vision. And it's bringing that up a little bit more, that third brief about what does this do in society? What does this do with the environment, et cetera? One of the things I've been playing with in my design studio's teaching has been a concept of three ecologies, one being personal psychological ecology, which is sort of very individual and self, but there's nothing wrong with that. It could be about ecosophy, it engages passions and things like that, meaning, intention, purpose. This is from Felix Guattari framework. It's very difficult to read, but I've been playing with it for a while. And the second one's a social ecology, which is about how we connect with one another. This is delusion of self, really. We actually a bit more collective, how we influenced, maybe even considers the fact that we're not the same person in the morning, let alone the afternoon, let alone the week or weekend, and how our identities change. But all of the aspects that are social, public, private boundaries, things like that. And there's a lot to that. And then there's like another ecology, which is about a natural, I often use the word material ecology, which is sort of non-human. It has its own agency. And Guattari really argues with this model, sort of conceptualization, is that like the challenge we have is that we sometimes consider two of these ecologies at once, but not the other. And that's where we create problems. Or we consider one ecology, but not the others, and that creates problems. We don't think about how these different ecologies relate to one another. And so I think when it comes to architecture versus urban design, I just think there's just different questions around how you treat these ecologies. Architecture is material. It's very spatial. It's got structure. It's got engineering. It's got form. It's got light. It's got how spaces flow from one another. It's got texture. In terms of physical design, and then in terms of physical design with urban design, you've got the natural environment, you've got questions of interfaces, you've got questions of density, you've got accessibility, you've got morphology to think about, as in, you know, the shape and the size of things in a broader landscape and how they change. There's different modalities of work, but they overlap quite a bit. And I think you can do them both at the same time. But if you're bringing participation into the mix, I think it's about trying to help the particular agents in that flow, stakeholders, clients, the specialist consultants, the authorities. Some of it's very simple. It's kind of a developed process. It's already quite well established. But some of it's actually about critically thinking, when do I want to involve people in those questions, in those discussions of how those ecologies mix? I'm not going to use the word ecology with people necessarily. So I'll think very hard about participation. So I'm doing a heritage home in Ballarat. I'm doing an extension at the back. It's in an area that council's quite proud of, the way it's developing, the way it's being looked after. There's nearby areas that are changing a lot. This is an iconic area that hasn't changed much. You've got people wanting to renovate their homes because inside some of those places are pretty awful, dark, dingy, scared of the north sun, all sorts of stuff like that, and had terrible 80s, 90s renovations done, and they want to do something that represents them but also fits their lifestyle. I'm going to want to bring the council as a participant into the process as early as I can so I can push the boundaries a little bit and understand what they're trying to achieve, and so they can understand what we're trying to achieve, so that when we put the planning application in, we're likely to get a permit and our client's happy. But I don't need them right at the start of the project. I don't need them when it's fully documented. It's like a critical decision of when to bring somebody in. Similar to my clients, like we'll get really, really involved at the beginning, particularly around the brief and developing the brief and understanding the purpose and what are we prioritizing, and we'll do options and such to try to test how somebody wants to live now and in the future. But then later on, when we're documenting a project, there's just no need for people to be involved in every little mouse click and line and things like that. So we design that participation process and we make sure that that trust and rapport and understanding continues through, because they're an important stakeholder. And we have a design sign-off meeting during documentation stage, all those sorts of things that help the process keep moving and that we integrate people at the right moments. But you got to think critically about, when do you want that stuff to happen? You don't want to pretend that you want to involve people when in fact it's not really a moment to be involved.
One critique which I often get when I talk about my architectural background, that architects or designers in general are trying to do this participation, but there is a point when they finish the documentation or even the development is finished, and then the designer is never back at the finished product. And they are rarely learning from the development, from the users, from post-occupancy evaluations. Do you think about participation and participatory design after the development or after the documentation is finished?
Well, I'd like to, and it's not very easy to get that happening. People don't want to pay for that, really. And sometimes people want to get on with their lives. I think some of this comes from a bit of a rational ideology that participation is going to give you the right answer, or everyone's going to agree. We need to make sure we got the right answer. And did we get the right answer? You know, another theorist from a PhD, Chantal Mouffe, talks about democracy and says democracy is this sort of back and forth between, they call it liberal institutions, democratic sovereignty. These two things are kind of fighting each other. One is a very individual empowerment thing and, you know, the freedom of that. That's a really important aspect. And then there's this other part of what's good for everybody or what's better for everybody. And these things need to push and pull across each other all the time. And the question's not about what is the right answer. It's not about that. It's actually about engaging in the process and keep developing. Yes, keep learning, reflecting, etc. Totally agree. But it's actually about, like, the emphasis should be about action. Should be about action. So let's have these arguments. And sorry, you lost the argument. I'm doing this. And it's going to be 80% okay. And we start doing things. It just seems to me, and, well, it's not just about me, a lot of the issues that we have around the future cities are there's these visions and plans about what to do. And we're hamstrung about to do them or not because we don't know if they're the right thing or if they're proven to be right or not. But like sometimes we just don't do it yet because we're sort of stuck with knowing if this is the rational, perfect outcome. But sometimes we just got to do stuff and this is good enough. And there's a bit of a resource of time here. This is not just a money thing. There's a resource of time. Like, but get on and start experimenting and doing a lot of this stuff. Now, back to post-occupancy evaluation and stuff like that. I think that we go through quite a bit of, in the visioning process, we go, these are some precedents. This is what other people are doing. This is how these spaces look. These are the kinds of feels we're trying to evoke. This is how it works in other situations. You involve more voices and perspectives in the process. People can test what's going on as a kind of a projection of the future as well. And that's super powerful. I've seen it so many times. I've had a community meeting or something like that. And you sit down, and I never used to be able to do it when I first started working, but after you've got a bit of experience and poise, you can sit down and you start and you start the conversation. Other people talk first, and the wisdom and knowledge that comes out in the first 3-5 minutes of the group in context, it's just priceless and it lasts forever. That's what participation offers. It hears those different perspectives. It builds on that wisdom through difference that I don't think that we need to feel any insecurity around, oh, are we really testing these outcomes or not? Are we going back to see what happens? Because there's so much built in around testing things already. Sure, we reflect. Sure, we want to get involved and analyze. And I'd love to do more of that in my practice. And I think there's a definite place for that.
You already started to talk about these, but what are the three biggest fears or concerns regarding the future of cities for you?
I'm pretty worried about a war. I think we've got this society globally that's becoming more and more integrated, more and more diverse, and people are caring more and more about difference, actually. I feel like there's a bit of a death rattle with, let's call it an old school, but it's kind of a neo-new school way of thinking about everyone being the same and such. But I think it'll do a death rattle, make some mess in the meantime. But I'm worried. Like, you know, we talk about China. I think half of my students are Chinese. I think there's so much knowledge to come from there. And in Australia, we've got this insecurity and we understand it geopolitically and things like that. But I just don't like hearing those drums of war. I think it's really awful. I don't think people want to live and think like that. And I think it's quite a real risk. I think people get scared, they get locked into ways of thinking, and it's really a pity. I don't feel like I'm qualified to make some of these comments, but some of the stuff we see just seems to me that there's a totally different way. That's real conflict. And I think the way that you treat that is we actually got to have arguments out loud and we've got to be hearing each other's differences and not just trying to resolve them, but appreciate them. And number two, when I start thinking about something, I think of a hope. I was about to say something about children and young people and the future of cities being part of their new way of thinking. And I've seen it with, I've got a 5-year-old and how they're being taught and brought up, not just through us, but the books that are available, the online radio, things they listen to. There's so much learning and awareness and education. Even like the teachers are amazing. We're raising our child gender neutral, for instance. So much psychological support as well that I know my generation didn't get. We're just learning all of this stuff in the last decade or two, but it's kind of normal. Sometimes I'm fearful that the process and momentum, almost like a sunk cost of the way the cities are going, future cities are going, there won't be space for that new generation to shape it. But no, I see so many moments where it's like Di Certeau talks about La Perruque and the wig or whatever it's called, about the resistances that just come out of totally strategic landscape that's totally blocked and ruled out. A little resistance, a different change will just totally subvert the whole system. And I see that happening over and over again, and it's kind of magic. So I'm not just saying hands off, young people will work it out, but I have a lot of hope in that space because I just see the wisdom. I've brought my child to community meetings and they might say something back and I'm like, yeah, that's the answer, everybody. Like, it's not that hard. And then I think I probably should go with another iconic thing, climate change and such. I think that goes a bit back to the first one about war and conflict. Look, I think it gets to hope again. I think there was a sense for me for a long time that there was a chance to change where cities are going. And perhaps I was a little bit more attached to the nuts and berries approach of the world and people getting a bit more local, getting a bit more self-sufficient, having a smaller footprint and things like that. I don't know if that is a medium-term future. Might be a long-term future in a dystopia, but I don't know. I think we're seeing just maybe I'm upgrading my thinking around how things work, but I think the way the cities are the way they are in many ways. And I think instead of finding a new way to conceive them physically and the way that we see them and how they're made, I think the how is going to change, is changing anyway. And I believe that people will inhabit them in slightly different ways. So that gives me more hope again. But I was for a long time a fear that, hang on a second, all of this effort to reconstruct a different city is for naught. Maybe in accepting that, we start to find another way of being. Talk about technology, for instance, and I'm a total cyborg, the way I use technology. I remember anything my phone tells me, put everything in there, and I don't control my emails. I just surf them, really, and it's fine. It's actually fine. And so I'm losing control. Maybe that's a good thing. And I focus on other things that matter. And I come into relationship with non-human systems and processes. And is it bad? Don't know. But it's sort of the way it is. And I think we find other ways to value each other.
Just coming back to your point about the younger generation, in my experience, I don't really fear that the younger generation will be stopped by the rigidness of the current systems, because they will be a force of change to be reckoned with. They will not be stopped. They will be much more forceful than the system could bear.
Oh, my generation, we've got lots of ways of describing it, but we've had to contend with trying to find our own space in a quick changing situation. A lot of our parents, baby boomers or children of people that just came out of the war and all these sorts of things, or people that have recently moved their family from one country to another. There's huge changes that have happened a generation or two ago and are still happening as well. I don't know. I feel like maybe we could feel some hope in my generation that we've actually set up quite a bit principles and have helped teach some of these people, and we've opened up some opportunities and all the pieces are there. Maybe we won't be the ones to kind of put them all together and or see the fruits of all of that labor necessarily, but we have definitely created enough holes and cracks and mechanisms for that to be subverted somehow or another and tested a lot of those things out. It's, again, that action stuff, I think. So I feel a lot of respect for the next generation, some of my students and my children. I feel a lot of respect for them. So I'm like you. I'm forced to be reckoned with. Let it happen. Something's got to give. There's been a rigidity, I think, in cities for a very long time.
And you seem, with this notion, a very generous person, because generosity is, sorry, old man, but you are not old, planting a tree which they cannot enjoy because it will just grow for the next generations. So with your teaching and preparing the next generations, you are very generous with your knowledge and with your time.
Thank you.
You also mentioned that environmental sustainability is long gone. What do you mean by that?
Like in terms of save the world, it's a good question. I think you're asking it very well. I was trying to be very easygoing and flippant about these things to kind of make a point. I don't know, let's talk about pollution or let's talk about emissions reductions and talk about, you know, when it comes to cities in my field, the main thing is about trying to emphasize living density in the center where there are people, where there are amenities, where there's infrastructure and not spreading all over the landscape and learning how to come together and share space. How are we going with that? I see councils in Australia gradually becoming more confident to advocate for these things. And I see students that I taught leading some of these spaces or people that I've taught with doing that. And I think some of the learning from abroad in Australia, what's been happening in other countries, both informal urban areas and formal ones. So we're learning from glottal settlements, we're learning from slum dwellings, we're learning from highly developed cities, we're learning from all of those, and that's starting to be integrated in our way of being. There are very long timelines, though, in the planning and development process. Maybe this gets back to your point of post-occupancy evaluation. There are long timelines that takes 5-10 years to really implement something in a planning scheme, then see it built 20 years out, really. And then it's to become the norms, 30, 40 years is a long time. So you want to make sure you're integrating the right things. I see that we're a long way gone and it will take a long time to come back. I see it starting to happen. Back to your question about environmental sustainability, I think it's going that way, but there's a long way to come back. And I think that there are some very fundamental things that still need to happen. Like we still ship a lot of our recycling abroad. We don't know how to manufacture the most simple things. Anything on this table is made abroad and has to be transported here and relies on an economy where our money's worth 10 times your money. And then it relies on a political system that expects people to be treated well in one world, but not in another to allow that to happen. So we're just a very long way away from that, which gets me back to my first fear about conflict, because there's some big changes that have to happen. And so our responsibility here is actually trying to build some solidarity between differences somehow. In terms of animals and pollution and plants and non-humans, etc., I saw the timelines. We've been talking about this for the 80s, if not even before, in the 70s. Like, it is way gone. So we need to be talking about what are we going to do with mass migration already happening? How are we going to be accepting of difference? How do we learn other languages? How do we learn other cultures? I wouldn't say the word integrate, but how do different cultures live together and see value from being juxtaposed and mixing and whatever? That's what the question has to be for city thinkers, I think. Like, this is the reality. We're going to go to 4-6 degrees or whatever. What's going to be the outcomes of that? I think it's so foolish to believe we're going to turn that around. We are so far down that track already. When I was a kid in the 80s and 90s, you saw the pollution in the world and we're still doing the same thing all the time, you know. It's a long way past. So I think we have a responsibility of doing some, having a response that is related to what is happening and what's going to happen more and more. So number one, back to the fears, I think urban designers and architects need to actively work on peace. Developing languages around peace. Peace doesn't mean keep things calm. It means help people have arguments and be able to have constructive arguments and be passionate and be different. Because that's a really huge threat.
So architects, urban planners, and designers could help these discussions going in a mediated manner. What are the other opportunities regarding the future of cities?
I mean, to pick you up a little bit on what you said just then, I think about mediated. I think that space is something very amazing about space. You know, there's some cool philosophical stuff about space being the same thing as time. And then there's awesome stuff about space being about power, empowerment, space two, space four, social and individual mindfulness, all those sorts of mental space, physical space, private space, social, material, those ecologies I talked about before. It's a phenomenal tool that we've been trained to engage with. And a lot of us have had 5, 10 years of studies or more. And there's a lot, very powerful tool. I kind of understand why some people don't understand what it is and it's not valued enough sometimes. But I also understand why it takes so long to get a handle of it. It's a very fluid thing and it has so much to do with process. My thesis is really, my contention is in the world is really, it's not just designing the physical space, but it's the processes of making that space and the empowerment of that space and the occupation of it so that when someone gets through that process, they know how to use, but they also feel like they can change it and modify it and make it their own and share it and be in it. Because I think we're creating, you know, there's this philosophy again, you've got that Heidegger being in the world stuff. And I think your being is always connected to your environment, but it goes the other way too. I think the environment enables you to be and become and change. I think we have a very important role to play. I'm probably curious to see in my own life and career if there's ways of contributing to more than just making architecture and streets and urban fabric. I don't know how that spatial knowledge could be expressed more, become more important. It's interesting, it's a real commodity space and getting less of it and our impact on it is actually probably where this whole thing stems from as a world. For me, I think the economy tells us that architects would do well to become more systematized and being able to do more with less and process orientated and business in a way kind of makes that important. But I think there's a real opportunity to do the opposite in a way, to somehow express the value of what we do. When I work with a client, I'm with them for 3 years. Some people go, whoa, that's true. That's how it is. And they're in the process of changing their lives. They've got a vision about the future. And let's apply this to a community group that I'm working with or a council that has a vision for a street. They've got an existing community that's changing. They've got certain contexts that are changing and factors that push things one way or another. They've got problems that are going the wrong way, that are actually diverging from the reality of the future and not responding to it. And so you're creating a vision or making a vision or representing or documenting or designing out one to test that future. And you want to work out how to deliver it. It's going to be an infrastructure that's there for a very long time. We're talking some of these things, the urban design project might last 200 years more. Like it's a long proposition. And it's got to be flexible enough to handle all sorts of types of being that we can't yet imagine. So you've got a particular existing community that's going to change. There's demographic changes going on, population changes, there's weather. People's way of working is, you know, even we just see radically in the last 3 years, like people work totally differently now, not just physically working from home and such, but how they connect, why they connect, what they're working on and what they're not working. It's changed drastically. No one would have explained this 3 years ago. But the buildings and the streets and the cities have to incorporate that or have to create the infrastructure to allow that to be used. And it's always this tension between what enables and constrains certain futures. But I do think it's worth us thinking about that process, designing that process into some sort of participation with different people so that it can be nuanced with those possibilities of not where people are, but what they're becoming. And then for them to feel empowered in that, such that after the fact, they can refit it and they can rechange it and they can then live in it in a particular way and they can be different. They can be there differently. I like using a house as a metaphor. You've got a family, one of the first questions I'm asking is, are you going to have any other children? Child's going to grow up. They're going to have friends. They're going to want to hang out. You might want to have two living spaces. Currently doing that job at the moment. Do you enjoy that work? You've got a hobby. What do you really want to do? Oh, I've thought that, okay, maybe in 10 years you might change that a bit. Do you think you'll always do this in your life? Oh, I might work from home in the future. Okay, well, do we integrate that thinking now in the process, or do we make it so that's possible later? Where are your finances in that? Do we build that whole thing now, or do we stage that? Here's the way that it could be adapted as we go along, as this goes along into the future for you as well, when I'm not even here. It's a whole conversation around the space and how that space goes forward as a container. Some things you want to be stiff, solid in that process so they hold ground into the future, and then some things you want to be able to be adapted and change. Changing all the time is exhausting too. So there's some parts of your life you just want to have a good foundation. Yeah.
And you also mentioned affordability.
For me, affordability is not just about low cost. I think there's just amazing knowledge out there that hasn't been accessible to a lot of people for a long time. And I don't think that's necessarily anyone's fault, or it's kind of everybody's fault. So, you know, people throw around concepts of, oh, architects only get involved in 5% of houses or something like that. I think affordability is a nice word, because affordances is a nice word, and affordances means something about the agency of that way that space or structure set up and what it could do and what it can't do. That's a nice word. And I think I'm still excited about what my practice here studio is offering about trying to do work for the other 95% and being able to provide professional service for that. And I reflect on the naysayers 10 years ago when we were starting, going, we're ridiculous and we need to keep getting bigger and bigger, more expensive projects. But then they have these forums and suppose you're about affordable housing, and then you're like, are you doing any of this work? Like, oh, we're doing a medium density scale. Okay, that's lovely. I would love to do medium density all the time. But what are you doing with everyday common people? Like, pejorative sense, but like, how do we do that everyday work? Because at the moment, it's all draftspersons and building designers and builders. You go to a builder and you get a design and build, and often it's the secretary that sits down and does a mud map with you and your family, and then you do another mud map with them, and then you've got a catalog of the things that they build, and then they send it off to the draftsperson and they build it. I just think it's exciting. I know my practice is trying harder to work out a way to communicate the value that we're offering and find ways to do it in an accessible way so that it's adding value all the way through. I think that there's an opportunity there that makes me sort of happy and makes me think that there is something around affordability that we can do. I like to use examples such as, I remember meeting people and builders that do really big houses. We're talking like 400-600 meter square buildings, houses, spending $1 million or $2 million on the house, no architect or designer involved. And then you go, why? I'll be with a client, and this is where it's sort of, don't want to sound too conceited, but you say, well, why do you need such a big house? Like, what are you going to do with all this house? Who's going to clean it? Quite often the man looks at the woman and that happens. And not trying to stereotype too much, but I go, well, why don't we make half a house, half the size of this house, and we do some really nice spaces, and there's be spaces for you to be together and do things socially when your family comes or when you want to be together. And there'll be spaces individually for you to have and get that reflection and distance. And that's what architects get involved in. And I think we can make savings. And I think that's where we start to explain our value and create cities, if you like, Benny, that afford us, that afford our way of being and our way of living and our becoming. I think that's what it is. Yeah, that's probably the connection and all of this thing. It's sort of making an accessible way of working, speaking plainly, organizing our processes, thinking about how people can get involved in them, communicating that, and making architecture or space that affords their being and becoming in the future. That's what affordability is about.
That's amazing. And what is your role in establishing the future of cities?
I'm just one person, but besides some lovely comments about megalomania that we sometimes feel that we've kind of got the answer, but we're only one person. Maybe it's you do all of that. I don't know. I've got an agency of one type or another. And I think that word of generosity you offered before is really lovely. I think that helps to fuel ourselves. I would like to get out there more and more as I've developed more confidence in my practice and thinking. I want to get out there and really speak more about this participation, not just participation as some rosy, everyone's happy thing, but something that we can actually bring out the issues that really matter, have good arguments, actually work out some of those friction points, or at least get some action on them. often those difficult points, if we focus agonistically on the back and forth tension of it all, we can find some really interesting moments for absolute change, for real interesting change, that it's uncomfortable change. It's quite uncomfortable. And I think I probably want to be an advocate to explain that participation is not always this rosy, happy process. But if we're wanting things to change and our cities to change, we want lasting outcomes, not lasting outcomes that it doesn't ever get developed or reoccupied in a different way, but valuable outcomes that take some steps forward from the stagnant cities or places that we've got at times into something more enriching, then we have to kind of embrace the vagaries of the differences of people and have that back and forth process going on. And I'd like to be an advocate for that. What would I ask others? I would probably say something about, I was able to communicate to people somehow. Like, if this is kind of interesting for people, could you think about what are the difficult points in your life, in your community, in the spaces that you're in interface with that you would be willing to actually have a go at changing and not just leaving it as it is because it's uncomfortable? Like, what are those spaces and what can you advocate to do something about, like move in action and to understanding of difference, understanding of difficulty, have some arguments? Because the future otherwise, I mean, that's the threat, is like we don't engage with this stuff and then it pops and it becomes a problem. But what are the things that we can start to get involved in? And in your life, can you step forward and identify those things that you want to happen in your life with people around you? There might be an argument or something around it. Just have that. Start engaging with that and start to bring that future towards you as opposed to holding it back or holding onto the one you got, because there's so much possibility.
Amazing request for the audience.
Yeah, I think so.
Eamon, thank you very much for your answers. I highly appreciate it.
Thanks, Fanny.
It was really interesting to hear from Eamon that empowerment through participatory design is achievable, though not easy, and applying the three ecologies, personal, social, and material ecology, to the design practice can be challenging, but rewarding. Not to mention the need to focus on actions after communication in participation. Professor Mark Burry, in episode 42, also talked about participation in detail. You can find out more about Eamon online, all the links are in the show notes. What was the most interesting part for you? What questions did arise regarding Eamon's approach to the future of cities? What have you learned from this interview? Let me know on Twitter at WTF4Cities or on the website where the transcripts and show notes are available. Additionally, I will highly appreciate if you consider subscribing. I hope this was an interesting interview for you as well, and thanks for tuning in.
What is the future for cities podcast?